I am Conor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, and I am immortal.
Looking for a dead guy named Nash.
You talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places.
I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain.
Everybody's got their problems.
You're alive. Why didn't he die?
Hey, it's a kind of magic.
Hi. I'm Candy.
Of course you are.
Hello, and welcome to Another Time MacLeod, the only podcast to our knowledge dedicated to breaking down and analysing the 1986 cult classic Highlander. I'm your host, Rob Wallace, and as always, it's lovely to be joined by my kinsman, Mr. Rob Daniel.
And as always, it is lovely to be here.
And on this episode, and also hopefully the next, we are joined by the wonderful Sarah Johnson.
Hi, very pleased to be here.
Oh, thank you for joining us again. It's great to have you back.
Oh, I'm pleased. I really enjoy doing this. It's great.
In this episode, we're going to be discussing the time period 40 minutes and 49 seconds to 42 minutes and 41 seconds, which starts with Connor sharpening his sword in the loft, so to speak.
Not a euphemism.
Yeah, not a euphemism. And then the magnificent transition through the fish tank into the lock, and a little bit of Sean rowing before pushing the truculent Connor overboard.
Rowing and singing.
Rowing and singing. We can't forget the singing.
B-L-A-N-C.
Yeah, so Sarah, what did you make of this?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you, because with a couple of exceptions, I think this is almost the most Highlandy kind of Highlander film bit of the film. It's certainly one of the bits everyone remembers. So I was so pleased I get to talk about this, because it's such a sort of standout moment. But I've forgotten how enjoyable all the stuff, anything with the Shawley Shumbershtake, Sean, is always good. But this in particular, the big pan up to the lock is an absolute belter, so I'm very pleased to be talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I love the opening of this. You know, there's actually a little bit of him, the sound of him sharpening the sword in the previous scene that takes us out of the previous scene when Brenda's looking at his glossy model standard police headshot with
smouldering headshots.
It is with smouldering, slightly confused into the middle distance, which we all know is because Lambert couldn't see anything. So,
but it works. He makes it work.
I also love, and there's kind of peeping Tom in through the window, isn't it? Swooping in through somewhere that looks implausibly like it could never be the back of where the front of where he lives is. But also that my first thought when we pan in, yes, we see him sitting there sharpening his sword in his non-so-80s sort of loft. Or, I mean, God knows, it looks like a kind of warehouse meets nightclub, I don't know, refinery. But also, when you watch it a couple of times, it's clearly got its own smoke machine, because the room seems to be full of dry ice or smoke.
That's literally a note I made at the start of this. You know, it's very moodily lit.
Yeah, I'm like, has he just cooked a lot? Has he cooked a lot of pasta and rice on a cold day in his house? I don't know. Is that what's happened?
Yeah, I mean, in this scene, you can literally see the smoke drifting in from the left.
It's hilarious. And also, there's floodlights outside the windows, which must make it very hard to sleep in his house.
Well, to be honest, I'm not entirely convinced that we just haven't gone back to Madison Square Garden and that it's actually a wrestling match going on around him, because
it is just...
It's like, I thought we were back in Madison Square Garden because it's such a cavernous room he's in, and the dry ice and all the floodlighting, it's like, I think he lives in Madison Square Garden.
Or a foundry.
That's my theory. Well, actually, what it is so Russell Mulcahy says on the audio commentary that the set for Connor's apartment was built in an old biscuit factory near the River Thames. So that'll be near you, Rob.
So that'll be Shad Thames again, won't it? Yeah, that'll be...
Yeah, that's right.
Because they're all gone now, aren't they? But there was loads of that kind of industrial-style buildings along there. I can remember seeing them on various train journeys throughout the years.
Yeah, all the old factories there.
Because was it the biscuit factory? I think, isn't there a bit of famous graffiti from up there, which was Big Dave's Gusset, which could be seen from the train? And I'm sure that was in the biscuit factory. If you Google it, it's a really famous bit of London graffiti that was in a completely looked inaccessible part of the sort of abandoned biscuit factory, or the bit you could see from the train, and it became very famous, Big Dave's Gusset, which was there for years, and you could be seen crossing over into Waterloo or places like that on the train, very famously.
Well, I've not heard of that, but I think we now have a contender for the episode title, so thank you very much.
Big Dave's Gusset.
Welcome to the Biscuit Factory.
Oh yeah, welcome to the Biscuit Factory.
Well, the thing is, I know where, yeah, the Biscuit Factory, I didn't actually put the two and two together. That's really close to me. That's right next to Bermondsey Station, Bermondsey
yeah.
Tube.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And they've got like a climbing wall and other things in there.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, some combination thereof, may need to head there under the pretense, I don't know, that we want to use the climbing wall. And instead, we're just going to sit on the couch and pretend that...
Sharpen a sword.
And record a podcast.
I'm sure are there studios around there to record, actually? I feel like there might be.
Yeah, there are. We might need to, at some point, COVID allowing, try and get as many guests who have been on the pod together, hire out a studio for the day, or, you know, at least for a few hours, at the Biscuit Factory, and just have some drinks and maybe record an episode.
The Biscuit Factory, that'd be great.
Sounds good.
I think so. We could do it for, you know, I think that could be one to do for the non-so-famous big scene where all the windows get smashed. That might be a good
segment
to do it for.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, because that was in London, yeah. And probably was at the Biscuit Factory, yeah.
Yeah, it was. So, yes. So we zoom in into his ridiculously 80s-ly appointed industrial space. There he is, sharpening sword.
With that incredibly long couch.
Yeah.
Like, very straight, like, whole, seems to be basically doing all the work of the furniture. It's the only bit of sort of furniture in that room, really. It's not just random objects. Like, you're seeing it several times, you're like, did nobody go, why is there a piano up on a podium next to the fish tank?
Yeah, <it's...
laughs> how does anyone get up there to play?
I mean, that couch feels like the setup for a gag where you just start panning across and just keep panning across.
You could do it, couldn't you? You could move around, take the corner out, have somebody run around with it, put it on the edge, just keep going, make it look like the eternal couch.
I think that might be his bed as well, because we don't see his bedroom. Oh, no, we do a bit later when he romances Brenda at the end of the second act, as was the wont of an 80s movie.
Yes, exactly. And Brenda are being mentioned here for the world's most catchy book title. I'm sure, I mean, all of us, want to get into publishing, need to run to our publishers with an equally as catchy title as, is it historic metallurgy? I'm trying to write it. Metallurgical history of ancient sword making. And for some reason, sword making is hyphenated. Which I'm sure is not.
Yes, I saw
that. Like, what? And apparently Highlander fans throughout the world have scoured libraries to see if there's any book with that title. And strangely, there isn't. So.
No, but I did like a quick search on that as well. And it was like, oh, this isn't one that someone has just done a quick kind of fan book of either. So you could just buy it from Amazon or something. But
I think it's ripe for a... Somebody's missed a trick. It's like in Ted Lasso, and gutted nobody's done Ted Lasso's mustache as a Twitter handle, as mentioned in the show. It needs its own Twitter place. But yes, with Brenda's picture on the back of the book, telling us that she is from Scranton, which is, of course, the location of the US office, which made me laugh as well.
Yeah, which is clearly, which if you think about it, since the US office, I'm guessing Scranton is intended to be the equivalent of where the British office is set.
Slough.
Which is just to say she's from the American equivalent.
Yeah, somewhere really weird. Yeah. She's from somewhere really sort of weird.
I need to rewatch the British office at some point. And the American office, because last episode, Ian did accuse us of sounding like Michael Scott, so...
Yes, he did, that's right. So this completely fits, because he also, of course, hails from Scranton, as does Joe Biden. So it's Joe Biden and Brenda and Michael Scott. So Scranton really should be more on the map than it is.
So Scranton must be one of those kind of in-jokey, you know, the 515 or 555, what sort of phone number prefix they always use.
Yeah.
If Scranton's a bit like that, you just say the people are from Scranton, if you want to sort of, you know, give them a from anywheresville kind of backstory.
I've just Googled, and I don't think, because the blurb of the book, which is great in what we see of it, we don't see the full thing, but the fact is, you know, I guess it was going to be appearing on a cinema screen, so even in the relatively low def, you know, mid-1980s, you couldn't have just had lorem ipsum. But I like how the fact that apparently she lived in 26 states when she was a kid, and her dad was an Air Force colonel and retired.
Yeah, it's, if you pause it, so I paused it this afternoon to see how much of that you could see, and yes, it pretty much is the that she lived in 26 states, and her dad was a retired Air Force colonel. But also, her full name is Brenda Jessica Elizabeth Wyatt, but Jessica with only one S. So there's a little bit of a typo in there, I think. I've never seen Jessica only spelled with one S. But there must be something behind the Elizabeth, because her author name is Brenda J. Wyatt, not J.E. So wonder what's going on there. Family feud.
I love there's some weird things with Highlander where there's far too much thought and sort of effort put into really random things and then just not into others.
Yes. And it has to be said, A Metallurgical History of Ancient Sword Making is a big book. It's like,
how much is there to say?
I can't imagine that's a page turner.
I mean, probably a fair bit. Connor's sat there kind of smiling to himself, and I reckon that's because he's just read the chapter about ancient Japanese sword making and he's like, ha,
some corrections going to be needed for volume two.
I dated pieces of the blade at 600 BC. The metal had been folded 200 times. Now, the Japanese didn't start making swords like that till the Middle Ages. So where the hell did it come from? If I could verify the existence of such a weapon, it would be like discovering a 747 1,000 years before the Wright brothers ever flew.
And also, I'm guessing, because that's the only logical reason that I can think that he suddenly starts thinking about Ramirez in order to introduce his narration and set up the transition through the fish tank.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Sometimes, MacLeod, the sharpest blade is not enough.
What a transition. I mean, it is the thing when people... I remember clearly seeing Highlander for the first time and that being one of the things where everyone was like, whoa! And even now, I mean, when I watched it with my son for the first, you know, the first time he saw it, he did exactly the same thing. He was like, that's cool. And it is cool.
It's so brilliant. I was... So Russell Mulcahy goes into that on the audio commentary. And it was... So basically, it was a prism lens, which is a lens that's like a diopter. So it can... Yeah, and knows that there's going to be like another image there as well. Yeah. And that was just used for the camera in the lock in Scotland. And they did the tilt up from Connor up to the fish tank and then up. And a lab just put it together. And apparently, it just worked the first time. And... looked so good that the editor phoned Russell Mulcahy at home and said, you have to come to the edit suite now. You've got to see what they've done.
Oh, wow.
And I got there and it was like, well, that doesn't need to go back to the lab, does it? That's perfect. And it really is.
I say, they managed that first time, and yet I managed to often fuck up the introduction to this podcast that I've now done 21 episodes of.
Yes.
Look, I try and do one of those fancy pan photos of my border collie, Dougie, and so far everything looks like Hieronymus Bosch. I haven't managed to take one yet that he looks like a dog in motion. He normally looks like a snout and a tail, and it's the sort of stuff of nightmares. So, and we, you know, look at how advanced phones are.
Yes, it is one of those, because the thing that was really impressive about it at the time, and still is that, because normally when you wipe from one image to another, you can see the line that's being used, whereas this, of course, has like a wavy line because it's
exactly
at the surface level of the water. And even today, it was like, how did they do that? And I was glad that he talked about it on the audio commentary.
It just is perfect. I mean, now we'd accept it with all the kind of CGI stuff, but it just looks great. I mean, it does look seamless. It's so well done. And the movement of the water and the lock, it's just, it is a banger.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stuff I really like in Highlander. It is best, I think, when it's weird and it's doing interesting, creative stuff straight out of the sort of, you know, playbook from all the music videos and adverts and stuff, but really, really creative. And you do kind of have to remember how big a new art form things like music videos and that kind of much more accessible way of making film was in the early, you know, in the 80s, which is why you get a lot of that sort of stuff. It really opened up. The technology changed. It was a bit cheaper to do things. Everything wasn't sort of going to cost you a fortune, and you're going to need the very best cameras, and you're going to need trained operators. And I quite like that you get the anarchy of stuff like this.
Yeah, because I completely agree, because one of the great things about Highlander is that it's all photochemical.
Yeah.
But there's lots and lots of imagination in there in terms of, well, if we can do this and if we can do this. And the transitions from what Russell Mulcahy has said was one of the things that were really, really planned out.
Yeah.
And the only one that was picked up on the fly was the Mona Lisa one, because they saw the billboard and thought, that's so brilliant, we have to do something with that. But the rest of them were very, very carefully planned, to wit, yeah, needing like a special lens for the lock.
Which makes sense when you give it the sort of, you know, time kind of travelling flashback nature of the story. It gives you a lot of scope. I would imagine that would have been one of the things he would have been interested in as a filmmaker with it as well.
Yeah, indeed, definitely.
I also like that the line that we hear Connery say just before the transition is, sometimes, MacLeod, the sharpest blade is not enough, because Ian, again, said in the last episode that he thinks Connor is an idiot. And
yes. And think everyone everyone thinks Connor's an idiot.
And the more I think about that, the more I am convinced that is correct, that he is just like a lovable dolt.
Yeah.
Because, and especially in this scene, you know, in back, you know, when we flash back to medieval Scotland again, and they're rowing out, Connery's rowing out across Loch Shiel,
singing B-A-L-A-C, like singing Balance, which I love. I love that he's singing Balance.
But obviously Connor's standing up because he doesn't trust the stability of the boat, but he's holding that oar like he's about to face off against someone in Gladiators.
I don't like boats, I don't like water. I'm a man, not a fish.
Oh, see, I don't think that's what he's doing. He's standing up on the edges of the boat, holding a weighted oar because he's practicing his balance for sword fighting.
Ah.
Which is why Ramirez is singing Balance to him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Indeed, that's...
So he's got an oar with kind of little things hanging off of it, which is when you do any kind of, you want to add instability. So I'm going to be really wanky now. When I do weightlifting and some squats and stuff, I'll put the, you can get heavy chains with kettlebells and stuff attached to hang over the barbell as you lift, because instability helps you build strength in your core because it helps you work on your balance. So he's doing kind of a yieldy version of that.
Wow.
Ah, so my initial thought was presumably Connor just thinks that they're rowing out to the island for a bit of training, but in this case the rowing was the training. He just has to be there and to balance.
Yeah, it is the training. Yeah.
And where had we seen that in a film made a couple of years before? There was a big Hollywood film a couple of years before that has a small scene that does that same thing.
Is it a Rocky?
No, but that is so close, Rob. You have to guess it on the next guess, because that is so close.
It's in that wheelhouse, not the champ.
No, but it is so directly linked to Rocky that, Rob, you got to have to get it with your next guess.
Oh, is it Rambo?
No, it's The Karate Kid, which was directed by the director of Rocky.
Oh, yeah, The Karate, of course, yeah.
Yeah, there's a bit where
he
tells Daniel to get to the bow to balance while he's doing his moves on a boat. That's right, yeah.
Okay, here, stop, throw anchor. Ah, good. Stand about. No. Bow, bow. Up.
What, up front?
Yeah, make flop left, right. Up, down, side to side. Breathe in, breathe out, and no scare fish.
And, you know, a million martial arts movies with various, you know, protagonists out on unstable surfaces or boats holding, you know.
Indeed.
Normally water pails, isn't it? In old, you know, in those kind of older kind of period.
It would always be water
exactly.
pails.
Exactly. And there'll be a fantastic action sequence on posts on a river or a bridge or something. Can't go wrong.
And you can't spill a drop either.
Exactly. I was just going to say, do not spill the water.
But I also love that this has one of my favourite exchanges in the whole movie, which is obviously the haggis.
Yes.
The haggis conversation.
Oh, and it's wonderful to hear Sean Connery in his soft Scottish brogue go, haggis? What is haggis? And then
you look like a woman, you stupid haggis.
Haggis? What is haggis?
Christopher Lambert go, sheep's stomach, stuffed with meat and barley. You're like, what? Are you Dutch?
Sheep's stomach stuffed with meat and barley.
And what do you do with it?
You eat it.
You eat it? Sounds revolting.
How revolting.
Just fantastic. It's so good.
I mean, this must have been written after Connery was cast, right? After they knew who was going to be doing this scene.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, this is absurd in its bones. We've got maybe the most famous, certainly the most, you know, recognisable voice for a Scotsman.
Scotsman in the world.
In the world. And he's playing an Egyptian against
Spaniard.
A Frenchman who is only just now learning English. How?
You can definitely hear in the voiceover where the slightly more Scottish version is there, and the voiceover kind of the voice bit he's ADR'd afterwards as opposed to the scenes themselves.
Oh, in the scenes where he's underwater, you can barely tell.
Yeah. He sounds quite Scottish then, but I was thinking the same thing, Rob. I was thinking this has to have been added in when they signed Sean.
And also, while I think of it, looking at this has made me realise who has to be Ramirez in the remake. They have to go Pierce Brosnan, clearly.
Yes.
I have been known to keep my tip up.
That'd be great.
He'd be perfect. And I think you've got to go ex-Bond. It's got to be him or Dalton, basically. But I think Pierce Brosnan, he's got the moustache, he's got the whole persona, he's a terrible singer.
Yes.
Where are those happy days? They seem so hard to find.
this is it now. This is the hill I die on. I'm going to be spamming them.
If Dalton does it, though, Dalton has to play it with a Welsh accent.
Oh, Dalton would be amazing as well. But I think, no, Pierce Brosnan all the way, he'd be a fantastic Ramirez. He's essentially playing that character in the Eurovision film, isn't he? Only a sort of Icelandic version.
I never actually saw that. Is that the Will Ferrell one?
Yeah, he's great in it as his dad. And everybody makes reference to his implausibly attractive father all the way through it, which is Pierce Brosnan. And it's very well done. He's got sort of a beautiful twirly moustache and beard and looks very... with a terrible Icelandic accent.
I think a Highlander remake would be the only circumstances nowadays where you could get away with casting a non-Middle Eastern actor as an Egyptian character. I think people would just go, that's fine.
Yes.
I think it always has to be done. Yeah, it's in keeping with the... Man, and make sure you're bang on your, you know, correct casting for all the rest of it. But I think carry on with Ramirez being the implausibly Celtic and Egyptian, I think, is the way forward.
Well, I don't know. I think get an Egyptian to play a Scot. I think that would be the thing to do. So,
or get a Scottish Egyptian.
Yes. This is, I think, the first time, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we've actually heard Connor have a proper conversation with someone where there's been a bit of back and forth so we can properly hear the accent. And I thought, that's quite clever they kept it until 40 minutes in, so we're really into the story and don't mind the fact that that is just a very, very unique Scottish accent.
Be still, for God's sake! You'll tip us over!
So?
I cannot swim, you Spanish peacock!
I'm not Spanish, I'm Egyptian.
You said you were from Spain! You're a liar!
Well, that's really, as you say, that's really interesting because obviously, as we've just said, in this scene, they kind of lampshade it by putting him against the most Scottish person.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like, we can't hide this.
To the point where it sounds like his own language, aren't it? Yeah. I mean, you know, the Scottish Highland accent is actually a very lovely sort of soft burr. And what's interesting is they film, obviously, Loch Shiel, and it's not that far away from the Cala Lacash, which is where my dog, Dougie, is from. And we actually drove all the way up there to get him before the world went mad. So it is astonishingly beautiful, and everything up that sort of end of the Highlands looks like that, like beautiful huge lakes and crevasses and lochs. And I expected everybody to have a very harsh accent, but everybody's got a very soft burr. So I mean, still nothing like what Christopher Lambert sounds like, just to be clear, but it is at least not as kind of as harsh is wrong, because I like the Glaswegian accent, but it's much softer and sweeter than you think it's going to be.
With Glasgow, there's a sort of scoop and rise intonation pattern, you know. There's that kind of feel, the stretch their vowels out in Glasgow. And then as you go up the Highlands, it's a little bit lighter. You can hear the Gaelic processes, aspiration and devoicing, coming into the speech. It's a lovely day up there, and it all gets a little bit more softened if you're over in the Hebrides.
But still nowhere near what Mr. Lambert is doing.
I mean, maybe the medieval Scottish accent. I mean, if everybody else didn't sound Scottish,
maybe he studied in France.
Well, that's what we said. Maybe he had
Sons
like
of Nobles,
yeah,
did.
You know, Kate had a French tutor, and or maybe it's one of those like kind of accent drift things where everybody used to sound slightly different. But yeah, I think you can come up with as many theories as you want.
When you're very isolated communities and you can't travel, then obviously the accent is going to be pocketed in that area and not change. And I always find that really fascinating. You get those, and especially places that are inaccessible.
How specifically pocketed to the room of the castle he was in?
I'm telling you, he studied in France. He studied in, that's clearly what he was sent off as a youth to study in France to learn Latin. And
he did.
Like in Braveheart, where they I don't know, they never really excuse Mel Gibson's Aussie version of the Scottish accent, do they?
No, that got a pass, that did, the fact that, that is a very Simpsons accent that Gibson does.
It's Gameskeeper Willie.
It's Gameskeeper Willie.
I think it's a shame that they didn't go with that for Christopher Lambert. Here, just go do this. Get Hank Azaria in. He'll dub you. It'll be fine.
You know, in terms of the Groundskeeper Willie, it's like, you know the enemy of the Scots, like English and Scots and Scots and other Scots.
Exactly.
You Scots sure are a contentious people.
You just made an enemy for life.
But it's that thing, isn't it, that even other, I remember reading a great thing on Twitter, which is even other Scottish people, when they talking about Taggart, they say mother, even more Scottish, even if they are Scottish, mother. So yes, there are various levels of accent.
Yes, that's
so maybe,
right.
maybe he's in a very, very weird area of Scotland that's as much closer to Paris than others.
Although actually, I've just thought, I wonder if there was any discussion of just doing a full dub by a different actor.
Yeah.
for Christopher Lambert, because they did that for Andy McDowell in The Legend of Greystoke, which of course starred Christopher Lambert as Tarzan, and she was dubbed by Glenn Close. So I wonder if they...
And she spoke English.
And she spoke English, but she spoke it with a Texan accent, and for Jane, the regal English lady, it just didn't work, but Glenn Close could actually, it turns out, do a quite good English accent.
Won't be long before you're talking like the rest of us.
I hope not. I think English is so much prettier when spoken with a French accent.
She does a really good English accent, yeah.
But I wonder if they thought at some point, we need to get someone else in.
We've got a lot of Scots in the cast, let's just let them dub him.
No, do you know what? I reckon they wanted to get someone else in, but they had like a reverse Singing in the Rain, Debbie Reynolds, Lena Lamont situation.
What do you mean?
Where they just refuse, like, you know, all the rest of the cast, you know, lay themselves down and say, letting you dub Chris.
Exactly. You've made your bit. And I love when you read about it, that they didn't even try and get him to have a Scottish accent proper. They just focused on a weird from everywhere accent for him.
I mean, that's clearly where the line, "You talk funny, Nash, where are you from? Lots of different places," came from. That was clearly added during filming just to be like, again, we're going to lampshade it.
Yeah,
indeed. I mean, it's actually one of those things where I'm glad they didn't do that, because I think it would be a much less interesting film if he was just dubbed by someone who could do a Scottish accent and then do a bit of an American mid-Atlantic accent for when he's in New York. To suggest that his voice has changed.
But it's a feature of the film now, isn't it? It's a whole, you know, it's a part of it now. It's the thing that everybody knows. And it's what makes Sean Connery being Egyptian Spanish even funny.
Yeah, indeed.
Although I'd like to point out, we actually have no proof that anything Sean Connery says outside of The Gathering is actually true.
Well, that's true.
Like,
including the fact that he's immortal.
Oh, no, in terms of anything outside of anything to do with his personal life, you know, "I am metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain." It's like, are you sure?
Really? Yeah.
I buy it.
He seems to be legit. I do. He does get the best dialogue in it. I mean, I love as well that his schedule only let him do like a week's filming, and by all accounts, everybody loved him. He had a bit of a hairy time initially, didn't he, on set, and nearly walked off, and then kind of went with it all, and everybody loved him so much. He was plying people with like friends' homemade whiskey and things like that. That I think that's the other reason he does get all the best lines. He gets all the good stuff. I mean, this episode, I love all those exchanges, the whole "what is haggis?" And then when he says, you know, "you have the manners of a goat."
"And you smell like a dung heap. And you have no knowledge whatsoever of your potential."
"Of your potential."
"You have the manners of a goat. And you smell like a dung heap. And you have no knowledge whatsoever of your potential."
It's just so good. And it's never explained properly why he chooses him, other than that he is so keen to defeat the Kurgan. But also, you don't, you know, it's interesting you don't find out why the Kurgan is particularly so keen to get rid of him so quickly, because I'm sure in some of the mythology that sprung up around Highlander, what the series is and everything else, that there's this idea that he was seen as he was potentially going to be this, the clansman was going to be a threat, which is why the Kurgan tries to find him and get rid of him. And I think it's a shame you don't get any sense of why does he see this potential in him, because clearly actually Ramirez should win it all, shouldn't he? Can you imagine? You know, he seems like he's the best. And
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting that he chooses instead to train the Cloud and give up his life for him as well.
This is the thing, though, isn't it? This is the archetypal hero's journey, and we've seen it very recently at this point in Star Wars, where it's basically, so you're Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? And because Obi-Wan Kenobi is like, well, yeah, he obviously is the best one around, but it's Luke's journey, and it's kind of the same thing here, isn't it?
Yeah. I've got to go for him to reach his potential. I can't stay in his way.
That's right.
Ben?
I mean, maybe controversial to say, but Ramirez gets a better send-off than Obi-Wan.
In a different way, perhaps. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I think so.
"Tonight you sleep in hell. There can be only one."
Yeah, it is. It's like, I mean, there's a really good YouTube clip that shows how the Darth Vader Obi-Wan Kenobi fight would look now if the film was made now.
Oh, is that one they shot using all the kind of the tricks? Is that the redone version? It's amazing, isn't it? And yet.
And they're throwing each other around with the Force.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
As opposed to it being two polite elderly gentlemen trying not to do their hip and carefully, like, knocking the swords against each other. Kind of, now you go, now I'll go, now you go, and I'll go. Well done, sir. You go. It's very polite.
Yes. And then a bathrobe being cut when he gets struck down by Darth Vader.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh. But anyway.
And yet, I think by that point, you're so invested in Obi-Wan as a character, though, that that's what makes the whole thing.
Oh, indeed, yeah.
And also the sense that he could easily beat Vader, but he just chooses not to. So I always quite like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I think that's the same as Yoda going off to Dagobah when he loses the first fight of the obvious war. It's like, he's not green, he's yellow.
Bugging out and calling it even.
Yeah.
Let's just bug out and call it even.
Look, let's just bug out and call it even, okay?
Like, wow, shame. But anyway, do you know who wouldn't have done that? Ramirez.
Shame. Ding, ding, ding. Shame. Oh, good old shame nun.
Shame. Shame. Shame.
Yes.
Ramirez wouldn't have. Listen here, you shit.
Well, that, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, he then tips Connor overboard.
Now! Get out!
No!
Kind of just... Which
yeah.
is one of those, did he always plan that he was going to do that? Or is he just doing it now?
I think so.
In like a fit of pique to prove a point? Because obviously, you know, he's very refined. He's just taken his snuff. He's had a bit of a sneeze. Achoo. He's been appalled by the notion of haggis. And then he just kind of goes, oh, fuck this, and tips him overboard.
He's just making I can't swim.
I think that Ramirez's plan was to maybe break him in a bit more gently in terms of what he could have done, but then he just gets so... Because he does get really, really pissed off with him and just goes, now.
Yeah, and then he just realises that he's adult and he's going to have to...
He's going to have to learn the hard way.
And I do, and he does get that fantastic payoff, doesn't he? That you can't drown, you're immortal.
Help me, I'm drowning!
You can't drown, you fool, you're immortal.
I mean, he gets all the good lines. And also, when you watch that again, Christopher Lambert clearly kneeling up in about 2 foot of water to look like he's drowning there, by the way.
No.
It reminds me of the bit,
it was in the middle of a lock and they...
Oh, really? Because he looks like he's quite sort of crouched down.
I didn't get that. It's very cleverly edited because most of that was shot was shot on a Sunday with just Christopher Lambert and Russell Mulcahy and just the cameraman. So only three of them. So the bit where he actually falls into the water, Sean Connor is not in the boat because they didn't...
They had to budget their time with
that's
him.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, because he literally had a week, didn't he?
Yeah, 7 days and that was it. I love the fact that as he rows off, he says, you're immortal, and then says a prayer.
Yeah.
It says, we ask you, Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
We ask you, Heavenly Father.
Well, no, actually, he's singing, isn't he? He's singing. I turned on the subtitles see if it told me what he was singing. Yeah, and he's saying, isn't it Dio? I can't remember what it is, but he's singing.
Well, the subtitles are, we ask you, Heavenly Father. And I then Googled that to see.
I think there is a little snatch of Latin before that.
Because I thought that, but yeah, you're right. I think that it is mis-subtitled.
Yeah, I don't know, because he's singing the Dio. I can't remember what it is. I did look it up, because I had a look, and it's a early Roman phrase, which it is a kind of prayer to those who save people drowning at sea, basically. So it makes sense if it is that. Yeah, and I can't... And then he does the Heavenly Father afterwards. I can't remember what the word is. It's going to really...
Oh, wow, okay.
And also a nice little holdover from The Name of the Rose in terms of playing a man of the cloth.
Well, that makes complete sense.
Yeah.
I think my final point for this episode is to comment on the weird plinky plonk bit of score as Connor is kind of flailing in the water.
Yes. Blink, blink. Yeah.
That's kind of like...
Which on my subtitles say, on Netflix, just say bright music plays. And I'm like, it does not. As it transitions down. How is that bright?
It's kind of like somebody's trying to play a bar of the Jaws theme on like an out-of-tune honky-tonk piano.
To avoid having to license the music.
Yeah. Oh, I want a whole album of that, please.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I've got anything else in here about... and again... Really like to see at least the chapter headings for A Metallurgical History of Ancient Sword Making to see the flow of the narrative, but because it is a big book, and I think I'd like to know how you could fill that. But anyway,
well, you know, I think, you know, at the beginning you talk about man's violent tendencies, and you talk about Cain and Abel and the rock, and how mankind's weapons have grown more sophisticated, but
yes,
that ultimately
I'm not sure,
the sword is still the most elegant form of, and so on.
Oh, I thought you meant Dwayne Johnson. Sorry.
an elegant weapon for a more civilized age is what you're saying.
Exactly.
An elegant weapon for a more civilized age.
Dioscuri, that's what he sings. Dioscuri.
Dioscuri.
Which is an old kind of Greco-Roman word for Castor and Pollux, the protector of people drowned at sea.
Ah,
well done. That's
that's because it was just such a weird thing to see on the subtitles. And Dioscuri is what he's saying. And in a way, it's a shame they don't do more of Ramirez spouting odd bits of Greek and then Roman and Egyptian. You know, that would be quite cool if he does.
So that's actually on the subtitles on the Netflix version.
On Netflix, yeah. It is.
Oh, because on my DVD it says, "We ask you, Heavenly Father." So I was sent off on a complete wild goose chase into Matthew 6:8, which has a similar thing in there. But it's, thinking, oh, right.
Maybe they're both right.
No, yours is right. And the clearly the person who did the subtitling for the Blu-ray just couldn't hear it and got some mates. What do you think he's saying there? "We ask you." No. Yeah, it kind of makes sense because he says Heavenly Father, definitely. Yeah, let's put that. Rubbish.
It could be as well... you know, the monkeys at work at Netflix and are kept in little cages, just have more time to...
That's right.
to look up everything.
I now wish there was at least one proper gag about him being Egyptian. Like, he's reading a book and then the camera pans over his shoulder.
And it's all in hieroglyphics.
Yeah, it's all in hieroglyphics.
That'd be amazing. Or he has an eye... Or just let him have a little Eye of Horus necklace or something. You know, it just doesn't need to be...
Yeah,
or you find out that the reason that all of that kind of hippie-style Eye of Horus and all that other stuff that you see collecting around, especially in places like Glastonbury, actually Ramirez brought it to the UK with him.
Yes.
And that's where it comes from.
That would have been great. So, yeah, this is just tat, really, but the tourists seem to love it.
Why is this 15th century wench got an Eye of Horus tattooed on her bum? Weird.
Or you know, it turns out that when he first didn't die, that he assumed he'd pissed off Anubis.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know.
Oh, that's...
been wandering around for a bit with a feather looking for him and a set of scales.
some proper fanfic going on there. That's great.
Oh, absolutely.
Like that.
But yes, it does. The clip does go out. I do love that. That line is a great ender for that section, isn't it, though? Like, "You can't drown. You're immortal."
Yeah.
Well, in which case, we leave Connor struggling in the... struggling in Lockshiel as Connery rows away to the island, singing in Latin. And yes, well, thank you very much for coming on today, Sarah. I'm very glad to say that we have you for the next episode.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Very excited about it. Can't wait.
Would you like to tell our listeners where they can find you online?
You can find me on Twitter as Strapping Lass. I'm on Twitter hanging around, arguing, sometimes agreeing as well.
Well,
I never see you arguing, to be honest.
I try and make reasoned points. I don't always agree. I agree to disagree. Try and make reasoned points. Although there's been some interesting discourse around the Matrix Resurrections, which I've kept very quiet about. So the way some things are going.
I just put our podcast out there from the movie Robcast and said, there you go. That's the official word on it.
Yeah, that'll do. That's my bit.
And how about you, Mr. Daniel?
If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at @rob_a_daniel. Find my writing at electric-shadows.com, at filmstories.co.uk, and at lovehorror.co.uk. If you want to listen to the Movie Robcast, then you can hear that wherever you're listening to this podcast. And if you want to follow that on Twitter, then we are at Movie Robcast.
And talking about films that have an important scene involving a large body of water, Mr. Daniel, would you like to... Rob, would you like to tell us a bit about your book?
Oh, yeah. yes, I wrote... Okay, yeah, that's I like it. I like the link in because there is water in there a lot. Yes, I wrote a book on Cape Fear, the Martin Scorsese 1991 movie, and... you can buy that from Amazon and Waterstones online and W.A. Smith online and Liverpool University Press website. I'm sure it's been...
Especially if people have got some vouchers hanging around after Christmas. I would say it'd be an excellent use of it.
Oh, well, that's... Yes, you can come on again. so, yes, and I... Yes, I have to say, I had a very nice Christmas of lots of people sending me pictures of them holding my book, and it was very nice to see that. So,
aww.
Yes. Yeah, cheers that, Rob. That was an extra plug. Thank you very much.
It's an excellent read, some excellent deconstruction. I recommend it to all film fans.
Thank you.
And I have done, to be honest.
Oh, thank you.
if you want to find me online, you can do so on Twitter at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. If you want to follow this podcast on Twitter, you can do so at McLeod Time. And if you want to drop us an email, if you fancy coming on as a guest or you have feedback or just a funny Highlander-related anecdote you'd like to share, you can contact us at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com. Well, until next time, all that there's left to say is...
Overtime, McLean!
Cool.